From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Private Eye Josiah Thompson doesn't carry a gun, but he does have a PhD in philosophy. He gave up his career as a college professor to spend his days and nights tracking down missing persons and tailing adulterous spouses. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Detective Josiah Thompson. Also today, the real-life story that inspired the new movie A World Apart. Screenwriter Sean Slovo grew up in South Africa, the daughter of parents involved in the fight against apartheid. Their struggle led to her father's exile and her mother's death. We'll talk to Sean Slovo. And we have reviews of a new biography of Truman Capote and of a new recording of Stravinsky's Song of the Nightingale. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Josiah Thompson is a detective who can quote Sam Spade and Kierkegaard. Before Thompson learned how to tail cars and track down missing children, he was a professor of philosophy at Haverford College. How the professor became a private eye is the subject of Thompson's new book, Gumshoe. He describes, among other things, how he learned to make surveillance an arcane meditation. Last year, he was named Best Detective of 1987 in the Bay Guardian in San Francisco, where he works. In 1976, Thompson was a tenured professor in his mid-30s, a former Guggenheim Fellow, and the author of three books, including a biography of Kierkegaard. He went on a one-year sabbatical that year from Haverford and moved with his family to San Francisco, where he planned to write a book about Nietzsche. The book was never written. Thompson got sidetracked. I asked him how he ended up working for a detective agency.
Well, not carefully, that's for sure. I went to California in the summer of 76 to write a critical biography of Nietzsche. The biography didn't get written. My marriage ran into troubles, and at a certain point, Hal Lipset offered me a job. Hal Lipset is a distinguished private investigator. I started to work and took to the work like a duck to water.
What did you like about it?
What I liked about it was a number of things. I liked about the fact that the work wasn't in language. It was in the world. And for 12, 14, however many years, I've been working in language. I liked the fact that working as a detective, you knew if you won or lost really quickly. If you're tailing somebody and you lose them, you lost. If you stick to them, you won. Liked the fact that there was a kind of gritty hardness to it, that to do it right, if you're doing surveillance, you have to know where the payphones are, you had to know which way the streets ran. You had to be able to take care of yourself out there in the world, and that's what I liked about it.
What's the first job that you had that taught you some of these things and made you realize you liked the work?
Well, the first job was the first job I literally had. I went in for a job interview on a motorcycle and was told an hour later I was expected in Oakland to start tailing some people in a violent strike in near the docks of Oakland. I went to that location. Found my man and, of course, immediately made the first mistake. I pulled up beside him on a motorcycle and asked my way to Berkeley. The reason for doing that was that he had already seen my plate and I couldn't stop in half block. He said, "Follow me," which was precisely what I had in mind doing. But, of course, about a mile later on the freeway, he told me that he got off there and I should proceed along the freeway. And, of course, so I lost him. I lost him that night. I lost him every time he turned around, it seemed to me, for the next 3 or 4 days.
You know, it does seem odd to me that a detective agency would put you on the job tailing somebody without any kind of preparatory work to tell you how to do it.
No, there was absolutely no preparation at all. I think in retrospect, although Hal Lipset, a friend of mine, will still not admit it, I think there was a little bit of stick it to the professor in all this.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. Give him his comeuppance.
Yeah, right.
Who does he think he is?
I mean, Hal thought this is pretty funny. A full professor of philosophy who he can hire for $5 an hour to work as a detective. So obviously you'd like to haze him a bit.
Well, I figure one of the things you must have learned is all the stereotypes people have about professors of philosophy.
Yeah, you mean basically the ivory tower, the guy who can't find his way across the street.
And wouldn't know how to tie his own shoes.
Yeah, right, right. Well, I brought some of those features into detectivery, and I suppose that's why some of my friends always refer to me as Inspector Clouseau.
My guest is Josiah Thompson, who's a professor of philosophy turned private eye, and he's written a new book about his experiences called Gumshoe. Now, you had written about Kierkegaard. Which of his ideas, if any, did you find were applicable at all, or that you were thinking about in your new work as a detective?
Well, Kierkegaard is known as an existential philosopher, and his views basically compose themselves around the idea that you can't get there from here in terms of orthodox philosophy. You can't offer a picture, ultimately, of what reality is or the way the world is, that there's some fundamental ambiguity in experience. I'm reminded of Robert Penn Warren's line, the awful ambiguity of immediate experience. I think that reflects Kierkegaard's views in these things. And that's what I found again and again in the detective world, in the concrete world of work as a detective. The ambiguity of experience, the difficulty of clarifying things, the impossibility, really, of clarifying most things.
But before you were talking about how things are kind of clear-cut, you know when you win, you know when you lose. You get the information or you don't get the information.
Yeah, but then you move on to the next question. What really happened? Who really is telling the truth, right? And at that level, you really run into a wall of ambiguity, I think. And that's the brilliance, actually, of Hammett in all of these things. Hammett, who I still see as the kind of patron saint of modern detective writing. Hammett did it in a different way. The Maltese Falcon, for example, the classic, Hammett's classic work, you start with a fiction, with Bridget O'Shaughnessy's false story as to who she is and what she's doing. Now, by the end of the novel, at the very end of the novel, unlike the standard Conan Doyle English detective novel, which begins with fiction and ends with truth, the butler did it or he didn't, Hammett leaves you there in the midst of ambiguity. Again, you don't know what the real story of the Falcon is. You don't know what really happened here. Some people have died. Others have been arrested. Various things have happened. But you don't know what the truth is. And it seems to me that that's the brilliance of Hammett, and a brilliance that he brought to this craft because he was the only modern detective writer who ever worked as a detective. So he knew the lesson that I had to take a year or so to learn.
Well, you agree with him that chance and luck are more important than rational thinking when it comes to actually solving a case. What's an example of how rational thinking just wasn't working for you, but chance and luck paid off?
Well, rational thinking very, very, very seldom works. I can give an immediate example of how chance and luck didn't work. On my first job, I was tailing this guy in a bus. Now, if you've ever, probably none of your listeners have really tailed anybody on a bus. It's a rather unusual sort of thing to do. But look, think of the bus. I mean, there are no windows usually in the back of a bus, and if they are, they're hopelessly oily. So if you tail a bus, you can tail right up behind the bus. It's one of the easiest tails in the world. I didn't know that. On my first tail, I tailed this bus about a block behind, heavy traffic in Berkeley. Since I didn't know the Bay Area, I looked down to a map. When I looked up, there were now two buses, two identical buses heading east on Shattuck. The result of this whole thing was that I lost the man. And that's what often happens in detective work. Chance and contingency are so important. For example, you can be sitting on somebody for 8 hours and never blink and do an absolutely brilliant job. And right when he moves, a bus pulls in and blocks your way out and you lose him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, constantly one's involved in that world of time and change and contingency. And the detective life, I think, has to do basically with how you get along in that world.
I want to quote something else that you quote from Hammett. I forget which novel this is. It's one of the Sam Spade novels.
Mm-hmm.
But the quote is, "My way of learning is to leave a monkey wrench." My way of learning is to heave a monkey wrench into the machinery.
Yeah, that actually is from The Maltese Falcon. And in another series of stories about the Continental Op, he says that his mode of operation is simply to stir things up.
And you do this?
Yeah.
How so? Give an example.
Oh, well, let me see. I'll have to find There is one case described in the first part of the book where I'm sent to New England. There's been a drug bust. Various things have happened, and there's $30,000 in a paper bag, and there's a can of drugs and some other things under a bush. I recover the can and now have to figure out how to get into the house to get the $30,000. Well, I stirred things up. I found first that the house was for sale, then found a realtor, went around to five or six different houses, and ultimately was successful in renting the house, which gave me access to it. And ultimately, my wife Nancy came over from California, and we recovered the $30,000. Stirring things up there had to do, I mean, how do you handle a situation like this? The DEA is sitting in the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know there's $30,000 there. What do you do? Well, you don't walk up to the door and ask the DEA agent for the $30,000 that he forgot to find in the attic. Right? So you stir things up, you move around, get things in motion, and when you get things in motion, then other things happen, other opportunities open. And I think that's what Spade had in mind in offering that notion of throwing a monkey wrench into the works.
So what was your monkey wrench? What did you do to stir things up?
Well, simply by getting into the position now of renting a house, which was something certainly I never thought of doing when I went there. Right? And then involving a realtor in going through various completely fake deals until finally this thing could be worked out. And then going through long involved conversations with the owners of the house, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was to get things in motion. And once you could get things in motion, then opportunities were available.
You know, one of the fictional detective characters I really like a lot is Lou Archer, because he's such a great interviewer. You know, he really knows how to ask questions to people to get information from them. Did you find that something you had to learn, how to get information from people?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any simple way. You ought to know this of all people, Terry, because you interview such a marvelous range of people each week. I don't think there's any simple way of doing that. I think you have to really listen to what somebody's saying, and then attend to, of course, body language, tone of voice, all those things. But I think it's very individual. I don't think there's any theory of how to interview somebody. Do you?
No, I really don't. And I think it's a very personal thing, too. But you really can't betray yourself when you're a detective sometimes. You know, you have to get information without people even knowing why you want it.
Yeah, but most often it's really straightforward. Most often I find that the straighter you are, the more successful you are.
You mean the more straightforward or the more straight-looking?
Yeah, right. No, Fetchheimer, my mentor, once explained this in terms of a parable from his history as a detective. He said he had this case where he had to get into the front room of this ground floor apartment, and he agonized over how to do it and how to do it and how to do it. Finally decided, he took an operative out with him and put the operative in front of the window and threw a baseball over his head through the window into the room. Then they went up very apologetically and got entrance to the room, did or saw whatever they needed, and left. In other words, oftentimes the most effective technique is a direct one. In that case, throwing a baseball through the window.
When you started detective work, did you have to learn how to look and act tough, tougher than you might have actually felt?
Are you kidding, Terry? I'm 5'8", 150 pounds, and I'm 53 years old. Look, I can't look tough. There is no way on this planet I can look tough. Winning through intimidation is not part of my repertoire.
Well, so what techniques have you found instead to look like someone who can take care of themselves? Don't you have to do that? Look like you can take care of yourself so that nobody else intimidates you or takes advantage of you?
Well, I think it's often more useful not to look like a detective. Not to look like any of the cliché.
You mean when you're getting information from people, that's more
effective? Yeah, when I'm getting information from people. I take it that you're thinking of situations where you might be in bad areas or in unusual situations close to criminals or things like that.
I don't know. In all the detective novels I read, there's always some kind of double deal involved, or the case becomes... The case goes much deeper than the detective ever thought, and there's terrible things waiting right around the corner, and, you know, there's some kind of violence usually waiting, even though you wouldn't have expected it from the case at the beginning.
Well, look, violence is something that the real detective hardly ever experiences and certainly wants to stay far away from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't carry a gun, I never have, and I never will.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't for two different sets of reasons. One, prudential, that I'd probably shoot myself in the foot, or somebody would steal it and shoot me, not in the foot, but somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that to carry the gun really means that you've dropped to the level of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I have a lot to do with areas of human life, with, as were the border between the legal and the illegal. And I don't want to sink to the subhuman and live in there. That's what the challenge is to try to maintain one's humanity in an area that's very hazardous for that. So I use my head, not a gun. If any detective ever used his gun, especially like these chaps on TV, they would have made lots of mistakes before they ever had to use their gun.
Mm-hmm.
So violence is something to stay away from. Use your head to stay away from.
Yeah, interesting points. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back. My guest is Josiah Thompson, who is a former professor of philosophy at Haverford College, but for the past few years he's been a private eye. He now is a partner in his own firm. He's written a book about his experiences as a detective. It's titled Gumshoe. More in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Detective Josiah Thompson is my guest, author of Gumshoe. Well, you've had your own private practice for the past few years after working with other detective agencies. What do you specialize in now that you can call the shots more?
Well, still criminal defense. Let me give you a snapshot.
Yeah.
3 weeks ago, I'm in New York right now. Three weeks ago, I was here in this area. And I was working on three different sorts of cases. One was a death penalty case for the Public Defender's Office involving scientific consultations with forensic pathologists in Pittsburgh and Atlanta. I took various pieces of tissue around, and we looked at it under the microscope, and I got their opinions and elicited their help in terms of testimony later on. That was one. The next case involved a case for Kunstler's office, the Japanese terrorist who was arrested, or the alleged terrorist who was arrested on the Jersey Turnpike with three bombs in his car. Did a little work in New Jersey on that, and then moved up to Toronto, where I have a drug case involving the arrest of six Canadians in Los Angeles for exporting allegedly conspiring to export about a ton of non-existent hash. I thought they should get a medal from Nancy Reagan for exporting drugs out of the country, but apparently the DEA didn't see it that way. So those three cases, I mean, that gives a kind of snapshot view of what I'm doing now.
Let me ask you briefly about the terrorist case. Now, I know you're not at liberty to talk about the details of the case because it's still in the courts, but this is an alleged Japanese terrorist who was found on the New Jersey Turnpike with, arms and bombs in the car?
No, there weren't any arms. I mean, I'm just speaking in terms of the press reports. The press reports report that the authorities found, I think, two or three bombs made in the form of fire extinguishers, filled with black powder and shotgun pellets.
So your job was to try to find information showing that the search was illegal.
Well, my job, I'm not at liberty to certainly broadcast on radio what I was doing.
Right.
My job was to perform some investigations for the defense, as I've done in many, many other cases, and pursue whatever issues the defense had in this case.
Did you have any second thoughts about taking on a case like this, given that it's an alleged terrorist who is the client?
Oh, there's no way that any of us can choose between our clients. We don't have to like our clients. We don't have to need any of that. Look, basically, my job is simply to go out there and get the information that the attorney or the client wants. And I can't ask those sorts of questions as to whether the person I'm working for is a nice person or an unnice person. I've probably worked for some of the most unnice persons on the planet at some point or another. But unnice persons deserve a defense just as much as nice persons. And my job is just to go out and do the job, not try to resolve that question as who ought to get a defense and et cetera.
You worked for the defense of William and Emily Harris in the Patty Hearst kidnapping to what, to prove that Hearst wasn't brainwashed?
Oh, that was an investigation a long, long time ago.
Can you tell me real briefly, like, what you did on that?
I don't think I can.
Okay, fine.
I don't think I can.
Ask me about all this privileged information? Or?
Well, here's what happened. Yeah. A deal was made. The case never went to trial.
Uh-huh.
And I do have very, very strict...
Fine, okay.
...intense strictures on what I can talk about. That's very relevant to this book because, see, I don't have a release from my clients in that case. In the book, in Gumshoe, I have releases from all these people. For example, Henry Bauer, the detective who assisted me in tying this guy up and holding him for 22 hours in Bombay as we took his child and took the child out of the country. I have a release from Henry. I have a release from the mother and child, things of that sort. So in the book, I can talk about these things legally only because I've been straight with people and they've given me their permission to talk about them. You're asking me about other cases where I just don't have that permission.
No, I understand. I didn't realize that's the way it worked, but now that you've explained it, I really understand. Something that you do write in the book that really made me think, you were in the process of working with a locksmith to get into a car for a case you were working on, and the police stopped you, handcuffed you, and thought that you were two real dangerous guys until they realized who you really were. And it made you think that if you were killed on the job, it wasn't going to happen when you were doing something glamorous or especially important, but when you least expected it. Does that kind of thought still haunt you a lot?
Yeah. If you speak of TV detectives never seem to be worrying either about what they're doing in terms of the right or wrongness of it, or worrying about whether they're going to get killed or not. I do a lot of worrying in this book about things like that. And I think one edge to the whole experience of the detective is what might be spoken of as a kind of paranoid edge. The point about it is that if you're dealing with the world, if you're out there in the world, if you have some sort of thirst for the otherness, for the raw bone of the actual, something that I have, then part of that raw bone is the fact that it can become very dangerous. And that the world is not within your control. So there's this level of always looking out of the corner of your eye and vaguely being aware that when something awful happens, it's going to arrive on you very quickly and thunderously, probably from behind. I kept thinking of John Kennedy in this regard. I wrote this other book on the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. As Kennedy was driving along Houston Street, Nellie Connolly turned to him and said, "Well, Mr. President, you can't say that the people of Dallas don't love you." The car made its turn under the depository. Kennedy smiled and said, "Yes," and within seconds the shots crashed into the limousine. That may be a kind of metaphor for at least how I view sudden death.
Yeah. Well, so how do you keep this maybe low-level constant awareness and fear from getting out of hand and becoming disabling terror?
By self-deception and humor. <I think. laughs> For example, my partner, we've told this story many times, but my partner visited a witness, and the next person who visited the witness later on in the day got blown away. My partner has always expressed that he has a fine sense of timing about interviews.
Oh, God. during one of your cases, you were following a woman for an adultery case. She found you following her and didn't know what you were doing, thought maybe you were a peeping Tom or maybe a detective. So she asked you for some ID. You showed her a card from your former profession, your professor of philosophy card from Haverford College. And she believed you, and of course you knew the part and how to play it. Do you think Haverford knows that you still have those cards and are using them as a cover?
Well, this was my ID card from Haverford. That was used in the very first months actually it was valid at the time. I had not officially resigned. I was still a professor of philosophy. Now, one of the interesting things about that card concerns the writing of the book. You see, the point about Gumshoe is that they're real names and real places, real events.
Uh-huh.
It's all nonfiction, the real thing. I remembered this incident, but did not recall the whole incident with the woman, and finally got out the card and looked and noticed that there was no expiration date on the card. And that reminded me of our little conversation in which she called attention to the lack of an expiration date, and I pointed out that in small Quaker colleges on the main line, they figure that their tenured faculty will not expire very quickly. And that then became part of the conversation. So it's the ability to, I had in these files, I had photographs, I had documents, I had notes, and I had the actual ID card in this case. The possibility of referring back to those sorts of artifacts for more and more information, I found to be fascinating because it was like an archaeology about rediscovering the past all over again in the very writing of the book.
Well, do you think Haverford College is going to reprimand you?
No, I was there yesterday.
Oh, okay. Let me tell you, I interviewed a detective within the past couple of years, you know, a real-life detective, mm-hmm. who had done a lot of interviews in his time. Mm-hmm. And after the interview was over and after he kept me totally entertained with all these stories of his cases and stuff, mm-hmm. I said, so, are you still working on a case now? And he explained to me that actually in his office, he had a lot of people who he delegated all the cases to, and he basically went around doing interviews. And I'm just wondering, now that you have a book out and you're becoming kind of well-known yourself, would you want to get into that kind of situation, or would you want to prevent that from happening?
Oh, no, look, I've got live cases going on right now.
Right.
I mean, I want to be back in San Francisco in 2 days because things are really going on in these cases. No, look, earlier I was part of a larger operation. The way to make money in the detective business is you hire a lot of people, you don't pay them very much, and you charge a lot for their time.
Right,
basically.
Right.
You know, Marx is right. Exploitation of labor is the way you make money. Right. I don't want to do that. I ended up, when I did that before, as a talking to lawyers and accountants. I didn't quit the academic world to become some sort of small businessman. I quit it to be a detective. I love it. And be going back to it in about 2.5 days. I better get back there in 2.5 days. No.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Josiah Thompson. He's a professor of philosophy turned detective. He's written a new book about his life as a detective. It's called Gumshoe, Reflections in a Private Eye. He works in San Francisco, and his new book is published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director Walter Hill. His new movie, Red Heat, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi. It was filmed in the Soviet Union. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Screenwriter Sean Slovo didn't have to invent the plot of the new movie A World Apart, she lived it. Slovo's parents were white South Africans working to end apartheid. As a child, Slovo struggled between admiring her parents' convictions and resenting their preoccupation with politics. Coming up, Sean Slovo talks about her life and its movie adaptation. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Stravinsky's Song of the Nightingale. And book critic John Leonard reviews Gerald Clark's biography of writer Truman Capote. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. President Reagan has broken his silence on the ethical misconduct charges against Democratic House Speaker Jim Wright. Michael Richards reports from the White House.
President Reagan says an outside investigator should be appointed to look into charges that House Speaker Jim Wright used his position and influence to help enrich himself, his constituents, and his friends. The House Ethics Committee, made up of members of the legislature, is investigating the charges. Speaking to a group of newspaper reporters, the president said that an independent investigation would make everyone feel more comfortable because of the relationship Speaker Wright has with the majority on the ethics panel. Until this statement was released, President Reagan and his spokesman have refused to comment on the Wright affair, but the issue has become a part of election year politics as Republicans try to defend against what's become known as the sleaze factor, involving investigations into alleged wrongdoing and even a couple of convictions of high-ranking members of the Reagan administration. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
A bomb has killed five British soldiers in Northern Ireland. Several civilians were injured in the blast in the town of Lisburn. Police say the bomb went off in a marketplace just as a charity run was ending. Authorities believe the targets were members of the British Army from a nearby barracks who took part in the run. Also today, the Irish Republican Army announced it killed a senior member of a Protestant paramilitary group in Belfast. The death of Robert Seymour of the Ulster Volunteer Force is said to be retaliation for the deaths of three people in a Catholic bar earlier this month. Troops are reported to be patrolling parts of the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince following an apparent attempt by the commander of the armed forces to decrease the power of a senior army officer wanted in the U.S. on drug trafficking charges. Alan Tomlinson has details.
Colonel Jean-Claude Paul, commander of a strategically placed army battalion in the Haitian capital, was ordered to assume other duties by Armed Forces Chief General Harry Namfi. Colonel Paul apparently refused, and Haiti's civilian president Leslie Maniga has now overruled General Namfi's order. Troops, apparently belonging to Colonel Paul's battalion, are reported to be patrolling several areas of Port-au-Prince, though diplomats contacted by telephone say the city is calm and there is no sign of trouble. However, the situation arising from the attempt to separate Colonel Paul from the fiercely loyal soldiers at his command appears to be tense and potentially explosive. The colonel is one of the most powerful men in the Haitian army. He was charged in Miami in March with conspiring to smuggle cocaine into the United States, an allegation the Maniga government has described as flimsy. It's difficult to say at this stage how President Maniga's move in support of him will affect the delicate balance of power in Haiti. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting from Miami.
The government today reported a 0.1% rise in retail sales last month. The small increase recovered part of the 0.4% decline in April. Data resources economist David Weiss says the figures for the past 2 months indicate that strong consumer spending, which has been driving the economy, is beginning to cool.
I think the consumer is slowing down a little bit. That's not surprising. He's pretty well tapped out as far as borrowing is concerned, and the saving rate is back down to around 4.5%, so a little higher saving wouldn't hurt the economy any. I don't think it means the consumer is stopping. He's still spending money, but he is spending it at a little slower pace than he was earlier this year.
The Federal Reserve Board today reported an increase last month in industrial production, 0.4%. The high cost of servicing America's foreign debt led to an increase of 18% in the nation's current account deficit in the first quarter of this year. The current account is the broadest measure of trade performance, including services and financial transactions, as well as merchandise. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 7 points to close at 2131.40. Advances narrowly outnumbered declines in trading of 150 million shares. The average price of a share in New York gained 3 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The French conductor Pierre Boulez is making one of his increasingly rare visits to America this week. He's giving 3 20th century music concerts in New York, 2 with his French chamber group, and 1 with his old orchestra, the New York Philharmonic. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a recording he's just discovered of Boulez conducting Stravinsky.
CBS Masterworks is a sneaky company. When they reissued Pierre Boulez's great recording with the New York Philharmonic of Stravinsky's The Firebird on CD, they added a piece that wasn't on the original 1975 LP, a performance that had never been previously issued. It's The Song of the Nightingale, not one of Stravinsky's most famous works or one of his greatest, nevertheless a delightful, colorful piece. A conductor like Boulez, who loves it and who has a great ear for pacing and detail, can make it glow. And it has a fascinating history. In 1908, Stravinsky began work on a short fairy tale opera called The Nightingale, based on Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor and the Nightingale. Stravinsky completed the first act by the summer of 1909, but he interrupted his work on it when Serge Diaghilev, the famous impresario of the Ballet Russe, commissioned The Firebird, and then, immediately afterwards, Petrushka and The Rite of Spring. In 1913, another commission led Stravinsky back to the opera. But he was nervous about returning to an earlier work after such radical changes in his style. He was no longer merely a talented pupil of Rimsky-Korsakov. He had become a 20th-century composer. He had become Stravinsky. When this commission fell through, Diaghilev came to the rescue. He produced The Nightingale at the Paris Opera in 1914. Years later, Diaghilev suggested reworking the opera as a ballet. Stravinsky still felt insecure about it and had been thinking about turning the music he wrote for the second and third acts into a symphonic poem, that is, using only the music he composed after The Firebird, Petrushka, and The Rite of Spring. This became The Song of the Nightingale, which Stravinsky completed in 1917, but which wasn't performed for almost 2 more years. A 1920 ballet version with choreography by Leonid Massine and exotic decor by Henri Matisse flopped. 5 years later, it was revised by a young choreographer named George Balanchine in his first major assignment for the Ballet Russe. The 20-minute score consists of an introduction and 3 uninterrupted sections, the fete in the Emperor of China's palace, the 2 nightingales, and Illness and Recovery of the Emperor. Probably its loose structure, its splashy post-impressionist colors, and its obvious Chinese effects have kept it in the shadows of the preceding masterpieces. But then, what wouldn't they overshadow? Still, The Song of the Nightingale has its own special blend of sinister and melancholy comedy that Boulez elegantly balances with its youthful rapture. Stravinsky's quiet hints that under a gilded surface, his score is really telling the story of how art and music can melt the icy heart of death. Stravinsky himself never recorded The Song of the Nightingale, so this lost Boulez recording is not only dazzling, but definitive.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a CBS recording of Pierre Boulez and the New York Philharmonic performing Stravinsky's The Song of the Nightingale. This is Fresh Air. The new film, A World Apart, is about how apartheid tears apart families. The story is told from the point of view of a white 13-year-old girl whose parents are active in the anti-apartheid movement. The girl doesn't fully understand their commitment, and she's jealous because she must compete with the movement for her parents' time. The screenplay for A World Apart was written by my guest, Sean Slovo, and it's based on her experiences growing up in South Africa in the early 60s. Both her parents were members of the African National Congress. Her father, Joe Slovo, was a lawyer who represented blacks who challenged the race laws. Her mother, Ruth First, was a journalist who reported on the extreme conditions blacks worked under. Ruth First was arrested in 1963 under the provisions of the 90-Day Act, which allowed the authorities to imprison anyone without charges for up to 90 days. Sean Slovo remembers her mother's arrest vividly and made it a central scene of the new movie.
You're not going to take the address book. You can't take that. It's got the telephone numbers of our doctor, our dentist, all the children's friends.
There are names and numbers of banned people in there, Mrs. Rock.
For God's sake, I'm a journalist.
Go on.
Diana, what's happening? They're arresting me.
Oh, no.
It's 90 days.
Oh, my God.
Mom, please.
Go and pack your suitcase, Mrs. Rock.
Come on, help me. Jude, don't forget to remind Gran about the orthodontist this week. Molly, you must ask the Abelsons to collect you for writing.
No books except the Bible. No writing paper, no papers.
I asked Sean Slovo what kind of reporting her mother was known for.
She was known for exposing conditions of migrant workers, of mine workers, of farm labor exploitation. This was her particular focus, but she was also a member of the African National Congress, and both my parents were very much involved in strategy and planning of the African National Congress while it was a legal movement up until 1961, and then after that when it became when it was banned and became an illegal movement.
Your mother died because of a parcel bomb in 1982. Did you start writing the screenplay after that? Was this a way to remember her in a way?
Well, I think, you know, what happened was that, like most mother-daughters, we had quite an intense and volatile relationship, and it was complicated by the politics of the time. Towards the end of my mother's life, and because we were both getting older, we were beginning to be able to talk about the past and about the anger, about the guilt. And then suddenly on August 17th, 1982, she was assassinated. And the feelings were still there and she wasn't. So that's why I wrote the script, as a way of coming to terms with her death and a way of resolving certain things in my own mind.
The story is pretty autobiographical. You were, I guess, like the young girl in the movie, you were around 13 when your mother was arrested. There are scenes in the movie where the 13-year-old girl is with her mother with police guards watching, and the girl is crying, saying, "Please don't take my mother away. Mommy, please don't go. Please don't go." There's a scene in the prison where the mother and daughter meet, and the daughter is crying. And the mother keeps telling her, you can't show your emotion around them. You can't let them, the guards, let them see you this way. Did that actually happen to you, and did your mother have to tell you to button up your emotions while you're around the police?
Well, if she didn't exactly have to articulate it, I mean, I took that from the way that she behaved in front of the security forces, the way she tried to maintain a sense of dignity and not let them see how they were getting to her. And I think, you know, it's the same effect, in effect, that, you know, that's what I took from her. Don't let them see how you feel. Don't give them any kind of satisfaction.
Now, the daughter in the movie has a growing awareness of what apartheid is and how it works and why it's bad. But she's still very young, and she hasn't experienced much of that firsthand. She hasn't experienced the oppression firsthand. She's experienced only the privilege. She feels very jealous in the movie of her mother's commitment to politics, her mother's commitment to fighting against apartheid. Is this what you went through with your own mother, wishing that she had more time for you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think like every child, you know, your parents are the center of your world. And so you can't help but resent the fact that that a lot of their time and energy is focused on the struggle on behalf of 28 million black South Africans. What it does is create some kind of ambiguity, because on the one hand, you want this attention. On the other hand, you can see the evidence of apartheid and you understand the nature of your parents' commitment. And so you feel selfish to demand that, some of that attention that is being focused on their political work. And that's, you know, a dilemma for the child, for me, for my sisters.
When you were a child?
When I was a child.
Did you talk about that with your mother when you were a child?
Not when I was a child, no. You know, I mean, later on, yes. And, you know, she said something very interesting in the years before her assassination. She said that had she and my father known the way the struggle was going to progress, they would have thought twice about having a family. Because in the 50s, early 50s, when we were born, I was born in 1950 and my two sisters after that, they were very kind of heady, optimistic days. There was a real faith in the process of democratic change, to democratic struggle to achieve, of peaceful protest to achieve some kind of progress.
Looking back, do you understand your mother's commitment to the struggle now, and do you still feel at all jealous of the time she took away from you?
Yes, both. The answer is yes to both of those. Both of those feelings. I mean, I absolutely understand her commitment. There was some dialogue in the film, which was in the final confrontation between the mother and the daughter. The mother says, "Would you have preferred it if we'd been different? If we'd been like your best friend's mother, completely apolitical and with nothing to do but go to the hairdresser and stand by all the time?" And the daughter answers, "Yes, no. Yes, no." And I think, you know, I mean, you can absolutely respect that kind of commitment and understand the choices that your parents make, and at the same time resent the fact that what it does is prevent you from growing up at a proper pace.
Your movie ends shortly after the mother gets out of jail, and she's basically banned. She's sentenced to house arrest.
Mm.
What happened to you in real life shortly after that?
Well, you know, as the movie shows, my father had left the country and on some kind of mission to do with his work for the African National Congress. While he was out of the country, there was the Rivonia raid where they arrested Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki and the others. As Joe Slovo, my father, was part of that policy formulating group, he became a wanted man, so he couldn't come back into the country. Then after my mother was finally released after 117 days in solitary confinement, she was then banned, which meant that she couldn't work in the country. And as my father was in exile, we joined him in England.
Easier said than done. How did you get out of the country?
Oh, you know, the South African authorities would much rather have had Ruth first out of the country than in the country in the threat that she posed to them. Those were different times. You know, it was embarrassing for them to hold a white middle-class woman in jail for too long. Now they don't care. But those were different times.
How did you feel about leaving South Africa at the time?
Well, you know, one part of it was excitement, but I think it was a huge disruption, particularly in my life. I mean, my sisters were younger, and I just think to go from the kind of country that South Africa is to the kind of country that Britain is in all sorts of ways, from the climatic to the social and economic differences was extremely difficult and took a lot of adjusting. On the other hand, I mean, you know, we were lucky compared to the experiences of many families, mostly black and some white, at that time in South Africa and today.
Now, this is the first movie that you've written.
Yes.
That got actually produced. How does the film compare with what you had in your mind when you were writing it and what you remembered from real life?
Well, you know, I mean, I had quite a unique experience as a film writer, and I think it's, you know, because of the nature of the collaborators, the director Chris Menges and the producer Sarah Radcliffe, and because also it was an autobiographical story, I was kept very close to the production through all stages, in the planning, through the shooting, through the post-production, and I was referred to and deferred to. So at every single stage, you know, I was able to give my input, and, you know, I think what is on the screen is about as close as I could have envisaged in an ideal world to what I wrote.
Sean Slovo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Slovo wrote the screenplay for the new film A World Apart. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned.
Hello, Terry. Hi. I have some questions for you today.
All right.
Can you match these cities with what they are the capitals of? Ready?
Okay.
Sumgayit, Yerevan, and Baku.
And the answer is no.
You can't. Can you match these places with the regions of which those were the capitals? Nagorno-Karabakh, Soviet Armenia, and Soviet Azerbaijan.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I give up. What do I win?
I'm sorry. You don't win anything. We're out of time. But if you tune in later to All Things Considered, we'll sort you out on this southern Soviet geography another day in the conflict between Armenians and neighboring Azerbaijan.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Truman Capote was one of the most outrageous literary figures of our time. He died in 1984. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Gerald Clark's new biography of the man known as the Tiny Terror.
I like everything about Gerald Clark's biography of Truman Capote except for page 535. Clark, a senior writer for Time magazine, spent more than a decade nailing down every minute of Capote's life. The writer with the wonderful ear, the sweet tooth for lyric wistfulness, and all those demons in his choirboy head. And the middle-aged waif who managed by some sort of biological regression to transform himself backwards from a butterfly into a caterpillar. The claims here for Capote's art are loftier than most critics will likely subscribe to. Really, comparisons with Proust are preposterous for a man who published so little, who was at best half-educated and entirely indifferent to politics and full of the routine anti-Semitism of the American upper classes who made him a pet. But Clark discusses that art with intelligence and wit. He quotes to dazzling effect. He finds the real-life original for every one of Capote's fictional characters, while also explaining the transfiguration of that original into something more compelling, something emblematic. He seems also to have slept in every one of Capote's musical beds and to have entered into his paranoid hallucinations. Toward the end, Capote was sure he was stalked by assassins. He woke up an elderly couple next door at his swank Manhattan apartment house at 6 in the morning. A friend found him in their kitchen, quote, "Wearing only a filthy bathrobe, which hung open to reveal his nakedness, Truman was drinking a large glass of his host's vodka and frantically trying to call Liz Smith at the Daily News. If she reported in her column the danger he was in, he said, the invading hitmen would be forced to leave him alone. So powerful was his trust in the magic of publicity." How had it come to this? Clark blames Capote's mother, an alcoholic who committed suicide. She couldn't stand her sissy son, not even when he was famous. But there have been many writers with awful mothers who didn't kill themselves with booze and pills. And it took at least 18 years for Capote to do the killing, in spite of so many friends and so many doctors. The spiral down began in 1966, which should have been his glory year, with the publication of In Cold Blood and the infamous masked ball he threw at the Plaza Hotel, to which his enemies were uninvited. But the fact is that from 1966 on, there were only fragments of the writer's art, and lies about the great unwritten novel, and talk shows and gossip columns and police blotters, the ugly relationships with men who were willing to be bought, and the bottle, which always wins. It's on contemplating this bottle that I fall off Gerald Clark's wagon, although it's been a wonderful ride through the letters and diaries and closets of the very rich, the very famous, and the very sick. On page 535, Clark blames Jack Dunphy, Capote's longtime on-again, off-again companion, for not having been there for the death watch. I quote, "Jack seemed to regard himself as a spectator, not as a leading character, and certainly not as the one who should have led the rescue efforts, however doomed they might have been. It never seemed to have occurred to him that 33 years of companionship carried a special obligation." On the contrary, everything Clark tells us and everything we know independently about alcoholism insists that after 33 years of not being listened to, Dunphy had to distance himself from Capote or forfeit his own life. The alcoholic who refuses help will drag every loved one down with him into despair and destruction just for the company in hell. The bottle was Truman Capote's mother.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Capote, a biography by Gerald Clark. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Richard Lewis, the neurotic comic, who says after he's finished his act, people throw prescription drugs and the names of their therapists instead of roses. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Vivid, the debut album by the rock group Living Color. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Bull Durham, a baseball love story starring Kevin Costner and Susan Sarandon. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Chris Bergen directs the show. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.